Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again, and welcome back to the program that helps you improve your American English skills. We come to you 7 days a week with interesting stories presented in a way that is easy to understand. Today, we begin with an English lesson. Jill Robbins and some friends will tell us how and why the English language changes over time. Then you may use some of the things you've learned when you hear Jonathan Evans tell us that technology is being used in an unusual way to solve crimes. Let's get ready to listen and learn. First up is Jill.
For VOA Learning English, this is Everyday Grammar. This week's Everyday Grammar is by a guest author, David Sullivan. He is Assistant Managing Editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer and Vice President of the American Copy Editors Society. Part of the reason that English has grown as a world language is that it adjusts easily to change. Unlike some other languages, there is no official English that must be used generation after generation, and there never has been. However, this means that what one was taught as a child in school may be out of fashion a couple of decades later. Slang is meant to come and go, but when common phrases change, it can make speakers feel wrong because they were taught that something else is right.
One example of this is a term linked to school itself. Today, it is common for people to say that they graduated high school or college. The word graduated has two common meanings. One is to mark off a series. The easiest way to think of this is to go back to high school chemistry class and remember the tubes used for experiments. They are called graduated cylinders because they have lines to show how much liquid to add. 10 milliliters, 20 milliliters, and so on. The lines make up a series. The other meaning is closely related. As you move through school, you cross off a series of achievements: grade school, middle school, high school, and college. So, in a way, school itself is graduated. So, when people used to speak of getting a diploma, they said they graduated from college. To graduate college would have meant, literally, to mark it off by year: freshman, sophomore, junior, senior. Similarly, to graduate to college would have meant to complete high school and move up to the next level. The use of the preposition was important.
But, as happens often in English, when people understand your meaning, smaller words, verb forms, and other parts of speech can disappear. I graduated college today is easy to say. Sometimes written language reflects the spoken one. Sometimes it does not. In this case, usage has moved rapidly toward graduated college as acceptable, if not correct. This may upset people who were taught that you had to use from to be correct. But this is not the first time this phrase has been simplified. It used to be that you said, "I was graduated from college," instead of "I graduated from college." The change may reflect how we think about the student and the university. Before, the emphasis was on the college. It graduated you. Now, the emphasis is on the student. I graduated. A search in Google's Ngram viewer shows a sharp fall in the number of times people used was graduated from between 1920 and 2000. The phrase graduate college increased from 1930 to 2000.
You can't predict what English will keep and what it will lose. Who could imagine that we would still say we dial a phone number when we now push buttons on our cell? Yet we know what it means. And of course, dial, like text, at one time was only a noun, not a verb. You looked at a sundial or the dial of a compass. People complain that English uses too many odd spellings, like through, T-H-R-O-U-G-H, or donut, D-O-U-G-H-N-U-T. Many want to change them to simpler spellings. When it comes to speaking, though, modern English speakers get to the point quickly. The question is, why are we complaining? I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Now on to part two of As It Is. Police and prosecutors sometimes recreate crime scenes in an effort to better understand complex cases. They may set up a room to make it look like the room where a murder took place. To do this, they use photographs from the murder scene to set up tables, chairs, and other objects just where they were at the time of the murder. Now, scientists in Switzerland are developing virtual reality technologies to recreate crime scenes. They say this kind of technology can help police, investigators, judges, and lawyers better visualize crime scenes. Jonathan Evans tells us more.
The scientists work at the Institute of Forensic Medicine in Zurich. They developed special computer software to create this virtual reality technology. The software program is called Forensic Holodeck. It recreates crime scenes using handheld, three-dimensional 3D scanners. The scanners show the user an object's length, width, and height. The scientists also use the Oculus Rift headset, equipment often used for video games. Investigators use the three-dimensional images to reconstruct the crime. The images are based on reports from witnesses and camera recordings. Stefan Ross is a radiologist at the Institute of Forensic Medicine. Mr. Ross explains how the technology works.
We scan the crime scene, and we are also able to scan the dead body if there is a dead body involved. And then we can put all the data together in the computer and create a virtual crime scene, which is a 3D model of the crime scene.
The software also rebuilds trajectories of bullets. Red and yellow lines are used to show their movement through the air. Mr. Ross says the technology gives the scientist a better idea of the trajectories than a traditional two-dimensional image. In addition to the virtual reality technology, the Institute also developed a robot named Vertobot. Medical examiners can use Vertobot to perform virtual autopsies in great detail. Robert Breitbeck is a scientist with the Institute of Forensic Medicine. He says the system provides a 3D model of the human body. He says scientists can make images of the injured skin in color and true to the exact size. This information can be stored and later combined with three-dimensional data which police can provide. From this information, he says, the scientist can do 3D reconstructions or recreate images from murder cases or traffic accidents. Several countries are already using both systems, the virtual reality technology and Virtobot. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. The Blue Point Oyster is returning to the Great South Bay of New York after almost disappearing from the world marketplace. Over farming, pollution, and Hurricane Sandy had severely damaged the Blue Point oyster business. Now the population is growing in its home on the coast of Long Island, about 100 kilometers from New York City. When the huge ocean storm called Sandy hit Long Island in 2013, it destroyed the Blue Point oyster beds. John Cochran is a councilman in the town of Islip. He pushed through a legislative measure to lease 1,200 hectares of the Great South Bay to shellfish businesses. 23 local fishermen, including the Cochran family, have signed up so far.
We have plots on this bay that were actually leased out by King George, and families still have a charter in Brookhaven from King George.
The Great Atlantic Shellfish Farms Company will be a major part of regrowing the oyster population in the Great South Bay. Marty Burns is an aquaculturist with the company. He is responsible for getting adult oysters to spawn, lay eggs, and produce the larvae that turn into millions of oysters.
Inside here is where all the larvae go after they have been spawned. The eggs and sperm have mated, and you actually have larvae swimming around here.
Marty Barnes grows the plant food of oysters, algae, in large tanks filled with salt water. The larvae absorb their algae diet for about 2.5 weeks. Then baby oysters appear.
Looks like a grain in the sand right now. It's amazing. Yeah. Nature.
After 6 weeks, millions upon millions of these little oysters are taken to farms in the bay. They are placed in wire boxes to grow to harvesting size. In 18 months, these oysters will be ready for market. Doug Winter is president of Great Atlantic. He says the oyster business has come a long way from the bay bottom harvesting of the 1800s.
With technology and advancements and the internet, people really being environmentally conscious, there's a big push for aquaculture. You can produce a lot more oysters. You can do it environmentally friendly. You can create reefs and clean estuaries and waterways. You can repopulate areas that have been depleted. And you can control your crop.
The Blue Point is back, and the oysters are not just good to eat. They are also good to the water. Each oyster can filter more than 150 liters of water a day, removing algae, nitrogen, and other pollutants. I'm Marcia James.
Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we continue the story of President George Herbert Walker Bush. He was elected the 41st President of the United States in 1988. George H.W. Bush was president when the Cold War ended between the United States and the Soviet Union. The Cold War had lasted more than 40 years. Both sides were heavily armed with nuclear weapons. People worried that one wrong move could lead to the end of the world. But by the late 1980s, the world was changing. The Soviet Union was dying. On November 9, 1989, East Germany opened the Berlin Wall for the first time since it had been built. The wall had divided communist East Germany from democratic West Germany since 1961. Citizens and soldiers together soon began tearing it down. Tensions continued to ease as communist rule in most of the former Soviet republics ended by the early 1990s. 15 republics had belonged to the Soviet Union. By the end of 1991, most had declared their independence. They became a loosely formed group called the Commonwealth of Independent States. Countries that had considered the United States their enemy now looked to it to lead the way to peace and, they hoped, prosperity. As the Soviet Union was dying, President Bush repeatedly negotiated with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. One of those meetings took place in the spring of 1990 in the United States. It led to an agreement calling for both sides to destroy most of their chemical weapons. The two leaders also agreed to increase trade relations. The American and Soviet presidents met in Moscow in July 1991. There, they signed the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, known as START 1. This treaty called for both sides to reduce their numbers of long-range nuclear weapons. They promised to cut the number by about one-third over 7 years. START 1 became the first agreement between the two powers to order cuts in existing supplies of nuclear weapons. In September 1991, President Bush said the United States would remove most of its short-range nuclear weapons from service. He also said the United States would destroy many of them. The next month, the Soviets announced that they would do the same. On December 25th of that year, Mikhail Gorbachev resigned as president as the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics came to an end.
Compatriots, due to the situation which has evolved as a result of the formation of the Commonwealth of Independent States, I hereby discontinue my activities at the post of President of the USSR.
6 months earlier, Russians had chosen Boris Yeltsin as the first democratically elected leader of Russia. When the Soviet Union collapsed, he became the most important leader of the former republics. President Bush and President Yeltsin signed another strategic arms reduction treaty, START 2, in January 1993.
Fellow citizens, last night I ordered U.S. military forces to Panama. No president takes such action lightly.
One of George Bush's military actions as president was to send troops into Panama in December 1989. They captured the country's leader, General Manuel Noriega. The United States had charged Noriega with drug trafficking. He had also refused to honor election results that showed another candidate winning the presidency. President Bush said he also sent troops to the Central American nation to protect the 35,000 Americans living there. The American troops easily defeated Noriega's forces. He was taken to the United States, where he was tried, found guilty, and sent to prison for many years. The United States then supported the presidency of Guillermo Endara, the winner of the election in Panama.
Five months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined.
In August 1990, Iraq invaded its neighbor, Kuwait. The United Nations Security Council passed a resolution threatening war on Iraq unless it withdrew from Kuwait. The Council set a deadline of January 15, 1991. But Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein refused. The United States and other nations were receiving much of their oil from Kuwait and neighboring Saudi Arabia. President Bush succeeded in forming a coalition with 38 other countries against Iraq. The purpose was to free Kuwait and protect Saudi Arabia against a possible Iraqi invasion.
This military action, taken in accord with United Nations resolutions and with the consent of the United States Congress, follows months of constant and virtually endless diplomatic activity on the part of the United Nations, the United States, and many, many other countries. Arab leaders sought what became known as an Arab solution, only to conclude that Saddam Hussein was unwilling to leave Kuwait. Others traveled to Baghdad in a variety of efforts to restore peace and justice. Our Secretary of State, James Baker, held an historic meeting in Geneva, only to be totally rebuffed. This past weekend, in a last-ditch effort, the Secretary General of the United Nations went to the Middle East with peace in his heart, his second such mission, and he came back from Baghdad with no progress at all in getting Saddam Hussein to withdraw from Kuwait.
Coalition forces began an air war against Iraq on January 17, 1991. They bombed Iraqi targets in Iraq and Kuwait. On February 23rd, the Iraqis set fire to hundreds of Kuwaiti oil wells.
It looks like what I envisioned hell would look like. The country of Kuwait is burning.
The coalition had the long and difficult task of putting those fires out. On February 24th, the Allied ground war began as part of the operation known as Desert Storm. That ground war lasted just 100 hours. Saddam Hussein withdrew his forces from Kuwait, but he was still in control of his own country. Years later, some Americans continued to criticize the Bush administration for not trying to oust the Iraqi leader. They believe that Bush should have sent forces to capture Baghdad, the Iraqi capital. After the war ended, Kurds in northern Iraq rebelled against Saddam Hussein. So did Shiite Muslims in southern Iraq. The Iraqi government crushed both uprisings. The defeated Kurds fled to Iran and Turkey, and into the mountains of northern Iraq. President Bush ordered American troops to help give humanitarian aid to the refugees. The troops established refugee camps for the Kurds. As time passed, Iraqi soldiers and aircraft continued to attack the Kurds in the north and the Shiites in the south. Coalition forces led by the United States established no-fly zones barring Iraqi aircraft over northern and southern Iraq. Coalition planes enforced these no-fly zones in the years that followed. By late 1992, drought and conflict had caused widespread suffering in Somalia.
I want to talk to you today about the tragedy in Somalia and about a mission that can ease suffering and save lives. Every American has seen the shocking images from Somalia. The scope of suffering there is hard to imagine. Already, over 250,000 people have died in the Somali famine. In the months ahead, five times that number, 1.5 million people could starve to death.
The violence and the collapse of the government were keeping many Somalis from receiving food and other aid.
The security situation has grown worse. The UN has been prevented from deploying its initial commitment of troops. In many cases, food from relief flights is being looted upon landing. Food convoys have been hijacked, aid workers assaulted, ships with food have been subject to artillery attacks that prevented them from docking. There is no government in Somalia. Law and order have broken down. Anarchy prevails. One image tells the story. Imagine 7,000 tons of food aid literally bursting out of a warehouse on a dock in Mogadishu while Somalis starve less than a kilometer away because relief workers cannot run the gauntlet of armed gangs roving the city.
President Bush, in the last year of his term, sent American troops to Somalia to assist in the aid efforts. But the following year, in October of 1993, 18 American soldiers on a raid were killed in a battle in Mogadishu. More than 80 others were wounded. That failed operation would haunt the American military for years to come. The events of that day were the basis for the book and movie Black Hawk Down. In December of 1992, as Bush was about to leave office, he and the leaders of Canada and Mexico signed the North American Free Trade Agreement. NAFTA called for removing taxes and other barriers to trade in North America. Some Americans accused Bush of sacrificing American jobs to lower-paid workers in Mexico by supporting NAFTA. Others praised him for supporting the agreement, which still had to pass Congress. But by the time it did, George Bush was no longer president. He had lost his campaign for a second term. In November of 1992, he lost the election to the Democratic governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton. That will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.